Welcome to Royally Screwed. My name is Chris Shearer, and it's my honor to take you on a tour through some of history's greatest, worst, and bizarre rulers. In this episode, we're going to look at the life of Lakshmi Bai, a woman who lived in British-ruled India during the mid-19th century. She ruled as queen consort and then regent of the state of Jhansi, which was a historic region of India that's located in the north-central area of the current nation. During her life, as I alluded to before, the UK had colonized India under the power of the East India Company, a trading company that had originated as merchants operating between England and the regions around the Indian Ocean. As with all forms of colonialism, this eventually was met with resistance from the colonized people. Though Lakshmi Bai was not one of the original members of the eventual revolution, her steadfast stance against the East India Company has earned her a notable place in Indian history. I also want to say up front that I was introduced to Lakshmi Bai in a way that compared her to Joan of Arc, and while I understand what author Michael White was going for in his 1901 book, Lakshmi Bai, Rani of Jhansi, the Jeanne d'Arc of India, it's not the best school of thought. Yes, they were two historical women who led armies, against the British no less, but that's basically where the two meet and end. Lakshmi Bai and Jeanne were two very different historical figures who fought for two incredibly different things. Hopefully by the end of this episode, I'll have made that point very clear. Also, we're going to have to look at a lot in the background of this episode in order to understand who Lakshmi Bai was. The East India Company was a massive powerhouse who operated for decades. But how does a trading company come to control a nation? And a nation like India at that? Also, as this is the first episode I've ever done over someone from India, what was the country even up to at this point in time? So, without further ado, let's begin the story. We're going back in time to India in the mid-19th century in The Rani of Rebellion. In the background history lesson, let's learn about the rise of the East India Company in India. But in order to do that, we should find out about the culture they basically took over. That would be the Mughal Empire. At the height of its power, around the year 1700, the Mughal Empire controlled most of modern-day India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Bangladesh. Now, that was the name given to the empire by the local Indian population. This name comes from a Hindustani version of the word for Mongol. However, the leaders of the Mughal Empire were not Mongols. They were from a region that would be in modern-day Uzbekistan in Central Asia. The name the Mughal leadership gave to their empire was Hindustan, meaning Land of the Hindus. And yes, there was a nation of Hindustan and a language called Hindustani. I love going down rabbit holes of linguistics and had never actually heard the term Hindustani before, which is how I learned that the languages Hindi and Urdu, the national language of Pakistan, are essentially dialects of the same language. Just that Urdu takes more of a Persian basis for the language, while Hindi takes more of a Sanskrit basis. Also, I'm sure calling them essentially dialects is a massive faux pas for linguists and the populations of India and Pakistan, so my apologies if that's the case. The Mughals rose to power in the early 16th century after the first emperor, Babur, defeated the final leader of the Islamic Sultanate of Delhi in combat. Though the state religion of the empire was originally Islam, the third emperor, Akbar, also called Akbar the Great, created a new religion called Din-e-Ilahi that would rise as the new religion of his domain. Din-e-Ilahi took the bases of Islam, such as the belief in one God, but added elements from many different religions and spiritual traditions from all over the world. A fun fact about the foundation of Din-e-Ilahi is that Akbar the Great was actually illiterate and therefore couldn't read the holy texts from the Quran. However, he established the Ibadat Khana, meaning house of worship, where scholars and theologians could gather to discuss religion. But despite the state religion being that of the Mughals, a vast majority of the population still practiced Hinduism. At the height of its power, the Mughal Empire was a massive source of trade with the European merchants who were beginning to ramp up trade in the Indian Ocean. It was also industrializing at a rate that would not really be seen again until the Industrial Revolution hit Europe in the mid-19th century. Before 1750, the Mughal Empire was producing so many goods and products that its manufacturing output accounted for basically a quarter of the entire world's manufacturing power. In 1712, Shah Alam I, the Mughal Emperor, died. After his death, two brothers, referred to as the Sayyid brothers, rose to power in the Mughal court after claiming they were direct descendants of the Prophet Muhammad. From 1712 to 1748, they essentially held power over the government, free to pick and choose who they wanted to rule. The system started to break down the power of the Mughal Empire. Even after the Sayyid brothers were forced out of power, further civil wars and local rebellions fractured the empire. By the mid-19th century, India was essentially just a series of semi-connected states, ripe for a larger power to take control of. So let's now talk about the East India Company. Before 1580, the Spanish and the Portuguese held a monopoly over trading in the Indian Ocean, mostly because they were the only nations who had managed to sail past the Americas to enter that part of the world. Well, in 1580, an English privateer named Sir Francis Drake circumnavigated the world and brought back some souvenirs from South and Southeastern Asia. This caused a drive among English sailors to break the powers of Spain and Portugal to let them partake in trade with the Far East. In 1600, a group of noblemen and merchants managed to convince Queen Elizabeth I to sign a royal charter to create the Governor and Company of Merchants of London Trading in the East Indies, which would obviously later be shortened because that's a mouthful. But yes, by the way, the East India Company fully had a political governor in charge of the operation, the first being a man named Thomas Smythe. The company was granted a monopoly on the English trade between the Cape of Good Hope in South Africa and the Strait of Magellan in Chile, so the Pacific and Indian Oceans. Any English ship found trading there not under command of the company had to forfeit their wares, with half going to the company and the other half going to the monarchy. After initially coming to blows with the Spanish, Portuguese, and Dutch, the company decided it would be a good idea to set up a permanent port of call in India. They had first arrived in India in 1608, but didn't set up a permanent trading post, which they called factories, until 1611. Profits soared afterwards, with King James I expanding the company's royal charter to an indefinite period of time, which would only be ended after 3 years of declining profits. In 1615, the company further protected itself in India by signing an agreement with Emperor Jahangir, which gave the East India Company imperial patronage in India. In 1686, the company attempted to push its power in India, resulting in the Anglo-Mughal War. The company, along with some warships sent by the English crown, were ultimately defeated. However, the EIC was allowed to stay in South Asia. Throughout the 18th century, as the Mughal Empire declined, the company continued to expand. It eventually was granted power over the states of Bengal, Bihar, and Orissa by Emperor Shah Alam II. From there, the company continued to expand and annex parts of the former Mughal Empire. They allowed some local autonomy as long as the rulers acknowledged the true power of the British company. And while this seemed to last for quite a while, company rule wouldn't last forever. After all, the Indians far outnumbered the British, even within the company's own army. It was just a matter of time before the cracks finally broke everything apart. In November of 1828, the woman who would be known as Lakshmi Bai was born as Manikarnika Tambe. Her mother died when she was just 4 years old, meaning she was raised primarily by her father. Her father, Morapant Tambe, was a military commander who served under Peshwa Bajirao II. At this point in time, internal conflicts had resulted in a huge chunk of the Mughal Empire separating and forming what was called the Maratha Confederacy, which was officially recognized as a semi-autonomous state by the Mughals. As Peshwa, Bajirao II was the second highest political leader of the nation, just under the rule of the Chhatrapati. Her father offered Manikarnika, referred to by the nickname Manu, a relatively independent childhood. He also taught her many martial skills besides the usual lessons of reading and writing. She learned horseback riding, shooting, and fencing, as well as the Indian sport of Mallakhamb, which is a sort of gymnastic sport revolving around doing aerial tricks on a pole. Imagine if pole dancing was a competitive sport and a lot faster in your movements, and you'd get something close. So needless to say, this girl was a force to be reckoned with from a young age. Instead of other young girls, it's said that Manu's closest friends in her childhood were two young men named Nana Saheb and Tatya Tope, who were around a decade older than her. These two men were also experienced warriors who for some reason were more than happy to let a young girl follow them around. According to a legend surrounding Lakshmibai's childhood, Nana Saheb was one day going out riding on one of his elephants. When Manu asked if she could ride with him, he refused to let her join. Apparently, the young girl proclaimed that she would one day own 10 times the number of elephants as him. Another story about her childhood says that when Manu was just 7 years old, Nana was looking for her on his horse when his mount went out of control. He fell off, but before the horse's hooves could stomp him to death, Manu appeared and leaped onto the horse. Using her equestrian skills, she managed to calm it down. Both of these stories are probably apocryphal, but they aren't entirely off from the truth of who this young girl would eventually come to be. She would eventually own many elephants and proved she was capable with horses once she became Rani, the Sanskrit word for queen. And she became a queen at the young age of 14 when she was married to Gangadhar Rao, the Maharaja of the state of Jhansi. According to the traditions of Maharashtra, the modern India state where Manu and her husband lived, women take a new name upon their marriage to their husbands. So, in May of 1842, Manikarnika Tambe took on the new name Lakshmibai, taking it after the Hindu goddess Lakshmi. Let's learn more about Lakshmibai's new home, Jhansi. So the name Jhansi can be used for many geographical features, though they all, at the end of the day, revolve around Jhansi Fort. But there's the city of Jhansi, which was built around the Jhansi Fort, which is within the Jhansi District, which is within the Jhansi Division, which is part of the modern Indian state of Uttar Pradesh. And when Lakshmibai was queen consort, there was the historical Jhansi state within the Maratha Confederacy. The word Jhansi itself probably comes from the Hindu word meaning bushes or undergrowth. So, unsurprisingly, the site where Jhansi Fort was constructed was originally a forest. There's also a bit of folk etymology that claims the fort was originally built but not named Jhansi until a guest of the Maharaja in the region who built it was asked if he could see the fort from the Maharaja's palace, to which the man replied, Jhansi, which means like a shadow and more or less than contextually means vaguely. The fort named Jhansi was constructed in 1613 by Maharaja Bir Singh Deo. As with many military forts, it didn't take long before the soldiers needed a place for their families to live, so a village developed around it. The Mughals then captured the fort and the surrounding area about 2 decades later, give or take a few years. In the early 18th century, local rebellions attempted to seize the village from the Mughals. In 1728, Jhansi came under the control of the Maratha Confederacy after a man named Chhatrasal Bundela asked the Maratha Peshwa, Bajirao I, to lend him aid. Chhatrasal then left the town and fort to Bajirao in his will. In 1742, the Peshwa put a man named Naru Shankar in control as governor of Jhansi Fort. Under Shankar, the surrounding village rapidly expanded. In February of 1762, the Mughals briefly regained control of Jhansi for 4 years before they were kicked out once more by the Maratha Confederacy. After this, Shankar was once more reinstated as governor of the fort. In 1769, a man named Raghunath Newalker was made the governor of Jhansi. During his nearly 30-year rule as governor, Mughal-aligned forces made a few more attempts to once more take back the region, but Newalker managed to keep Jhansi under his control. This strength allowed Jhansi to become semi-independent from the rest of the Maratha Confederacy, becoming something more akin to a vassal state than a full-blown member. Raghunath was succeeded by his brother, Shiv Hari. Under the second Newalker, walls were constructed around the town of Jhansi to further fortify its position. In 1804, Shiv Hari signed an agreement with the East India Company that truly made Jhansi independent from the Maratha Confederacy, as long as the Newalker dynasty accepted that Britain was the true power within India. In a treaty signed in 1818, overlordship of Jhansi was given to the British. Shiv Hari was succeeded by his grandson Ramchandra. In 1832, he was given the title Maharaja by the EIC, which also transformed the region into the Jhansi state. Three Maharajas later, we get Gangadhar Rao Newalker, the man who would marry Lakshmi Bai. It should also be noted that the patron deity of the Newalker dynasty was the goddess Lakshmi, which might explain why she was named that. So her full name after her marriage would actually be Lakshmi Bai Newalker, Rani of Jhansi. We don't really know much about how things went for most of the time Lakshmi Bai and Gangadhar Rao were married. It's been believed that she was allowed to partake in much of her previously enjoyed pastimes, aka activities mostly enjoyed by the men of her culture. How her husband felt about this is unknown. Also, in a rare event for this time period, Lakshmi Bai was allowed to train a group of women in martial arts. In a Muslim home or palace within India, there was a section called the Zenana, which was where the woman mostly lived. In this sense, it was comparable to the harem, which yes was an actual part of a palace and not a weird sexual thing. The Zenana was also usually guarded by women, but it was a novel concept for these female guards to actually be trained by the Rani herself. 9 years after her marriage to Gangadhar Rao, Lakshmi Bai gave birth to a boy who was named Damodar Rao. Unfortunately for the couple, Damodar died just 4 months after his birth from an unstated disease. The couple never gave birth to any other children. Then, in November of 1853, Gangadhar Rao passed away. The day before his death, due to him being on his deathbed and not having an heir, the couple adopted a young boy named Anand Rao. His name was changed to Damodar Rao, yep, the same name as their dead son. This practice of last-second adoption to ensure the protection of a bloodline's power was fairly common among Indian nobility. Unfortunately, this was not something the British were willing to put up with. At this point in time, the British Governor General of India was James Brown Ramsay, the Marquess of Dalhousie. In 1849, he introduced the Doctrine of Lapse. This legislation decreed that any princely state, meaning the independent Indian states that recognized Britain's authority in the region, whose leader died without an heir would forfeit their status as a princely state and fall directly under British rule. Dalhousie would often bend the rules of the doctrine in order to bring more power to the British monarchy within the region. I'm sure you can probably guess where this is going. Now, despite the fact that Lakshmi Bai and Gangadhar Rao had adopted their son with proper authority, meaning a British officer was there to witness the event, Dalhousie decided this wasn't good enough. Damodar Rao was not the blood-related son of Maharaja Gangadhar Rao, and therefore not the true leader of the nation. Even with Lakshmi Bai still alive and very much holding power, the British quickly annexed Jhansi into their dominion. For what it's worth, Lakshmi Bai very much argued against this case. Jhansi had been a loyal ally, helping Britain with its wars in southern Asia. She argued that the state had been properly recognized several times since the New Walkers took control. Damodar's adoption was according to tradition that the British had recognized in the past. Unfortunately, Dalhousie was unwilling to listen, insisting that Jhansi was not a profitable investment under native leadership. So, in late spring of 1854, Lakshmi Bai was ordered by the EIC to abandon Fort Jhansi. During all of the story so far, the whispers of rebellion in India were beginning to gather strength. There was no singular reason for the rebellion unless you labeled all of the sources under the banner of British rule was incompatible with life in India. Indian culture is incredibly structured and filled with traditions that would take more than a single episode to explain, which I guess is true of every culture, to be honest. For instance, the caste system, a social hierarchy, had been in place in India for ages by that point, but the British acted against it. Well, actually, the British more or less super enforced it and changed the caste system to be something more akin to Western forms of racism. While people in cultures that don't have a more rigid social structure might find this practice archaic, it was still an important facet of Indian life. So having men of different castes serve alongside each other in the EIC's army proved difficult to manage, as they had different rules for each caste and had to accommodate that social rule. India was also a predominantly Hindu and Muslim region at this time. A reason for rebellion that I saw brought up many times in my research had to do with the new rifles being used by the company's military. The Enfield Pattern 1853 rifle had a narrower barrel, so any gunpowder cartridges had to be greased up in order to properly fire the weapon. With a paper cartridge, you have to bite off one of the ends so that the gunpowder can properly ignite and fire the bullet. Well, these paper cartridges were said to be greased with both pig and cow fat. Eating pigs is against the rules of Islam, and eating cows is forbidden for most people in India. When word spread throughout the army about this, it caused an uproar. And even after the problem was allegedly solved, rumors that the British were still attempting to use pork and beef fat in the cartridges spread throughout the native soldiers. Going along with religion, the British brought over Christian missionaries to India. Word spread among the Indians that the British were attempting to convert them by force. By the time civil unrest was starting to reach its boiling point, rumors of mass conversion were taken as the truth. The first true act of rebellion occurred on the 29th of March 1857 when an Indian infantryman named Mangal Pandey openly declared his intent to rebel against his regiment's leadership regarding all of the previously mentioned reasons. When two higher-ups tried to make him compliant, Pandey fired at both men, killing one of their horses. When another British leader asked an Indian commander to arrest Pandey, the man refused. After Pandey failed to incite a larger riot, and then failed at taking his own life, the young man was hanged for treason. The man who refused to arrest him was hanged in late April. The rest of Pandey's regiment was stripped of their ranks. Word spread about this incident and caused further uprisings throughout company-controlled land in the region. Now, here's the thing though. The Indian Rebellion of 1857, while spread throughout EIC-controlled India, was not actually this widespread cultural uprising. The rebels were mostly found among Indian members of the nobility and the military, but even then, not in every state. Over the course of the war, many Indians actually fought on the side of the British to put down the rebels. Some Indians refused to fight when the Mughal Emperor, Bahadur Shah II, publicly supported the rebels, as many Indians were not looking for a return to a time when Muslims controlled the Hindu population. War was in full scale as India started fracturing into different groups. British versus Indian, Sikh versus Hindu versus Muslim versus Christian, high caste versus low caste, state versus state, citizen versus soldier. Throughout the early stages of unrest, Chauncey had remained neutral. But in the summer of 1857, the rebellion came knocking on Lakshmi Bai's door. Rani Lakshmi Bai was actually hesitant about the rebellion when things first started. After all, she knew the power of the British. They had taken everything from her, and she was doing what little she could to make sure they did not destroy the state she held dear. In fact, she ended up asking the British officers who now occupied Fort Chauncey if they could supply her with guards in order to protect the Rani and her son if rebels should come to the city. Well, rebels finally did come to Chauncey in June of 1857. The Indian soldiers marched into Fort Chauncey and overpowered the EIC's troops. And even after convincing the British to surrender, the Indian rebels still chose to kill each soldier and their family. Whether or not Lakshmi Bai was involved with this act is unknown, though some sources I've seen seem to point to this moment that the Rani of Chauncey realized she could not be complacent as the war waged on. Unfortunately, her desire to not get involved meant she allied herself with the British. With no officers left in Fort Chauncey to control the local government, Lakshmi Bai took power into her own hands. After messaging the British about the events that had befallen Fort Chauncey, the Rani was given permission to lead local administrative duties. Over the course of the next 2 months, several attempts were made by the rebels to seize Fort Chauncey. Lakshmi Bai managed to repel all efforts. However, when she requested reinforcements from the EIC government, they refused. By August, rumors had started circulating that Lakshmi Bai was responsible for the massacre in Fort Chauncey back in June. So, on her own, she continued to watch over her home. Luckily, the following months proved to be relatively peaceful. However, something seemed to have changed within Lakshmi Bai over that period. Perhaps it was due to the fact that, after repeated pleas, the British had still not sent reinforcements. Perhaps it was due to the politicians who made up her personal council, who at this point were becoming increasingly anti-British. Whatever the case, British troops finally did arrive at Chauncey in March of 1858. The British, led by a man named Hugh Rose, found themselves in front of a heavily defended city. Lakshmi Bai had set up gunners along every wall who could fire ranged shots across the landscape. In some sources, the British immediately started firing on the walls when they saw these soldiers, hoping to take back Chauncey from the Rani and her troops. Other sources say that Rose called for Lakshmi Bai to surrender her fort back to British control. However, Lakshmi Bai responded that her people would fight for their independence, and they would either succeed or become martyrs to spur on a greater cause. On the 23rd of March, the siege of Chauncey began. Despite the British having heavy artillery, they were unable to break past the constant barrage of gunshots from the Rani's troops. Lakshmi Bai sent word to Tatya Tope, one of the older men she had befriended in her childhood. By this point, both Tatya Tope and Nana Saheb had become major figures on the rebel side of the war. When he received the news that Chauncey was under attack, Tatya Tope led a relief army of about 20,000 soldiers to fight off the British. Unfortunately, when they arrived on the 31st of March, Tope's army was met with staunch resistance from the EIC army. And even though they were sandwiched between gunshot barrages from Lakshmi Bai's army and the soldiers led by Tatya Tope, the British continued to fight on. On the 2nd of April, the British finally managed to get over the walls of Chauncey and wreaked havoc throughout the city. Lakshmi Bai was forced to flee from her palace into the further protected fort. But even then, she knew it was only a matter of time before the British broke through. She would either have to face being kidnapped and probably killed, or escape to fight alongside her allies. This next part is a little weird and probably just part of tradition, but I think it's fun, so I'll include it. So first, you need to know that Lakshmi Bai's son, Damodar Rao, was actually about 7.5 years old by this point. However, if you were to see any art depicting Lakshmi Bai during the siege of Chauncey, he's usually portrayed as a baby. Anyways, let's just say Damodar Rao was a small 7-year-old for this to work. The Rani tied her son to her back and leaped off the walls of her fort onto a horse waiting below. She managed to ride out to join her allies, but in doing so, she had forfeited the fate of her city. Chansey would fall into British hands. Lakshmi Bai managed to regroup with Tatya Tope in the city of Kalpi, and they prepared the town for the inevitable arrival of the East India Company. On the 22nd of May, the British arrived. Lakshmi Bai personally led the rebels, but her army was defeated and forced to flee. The rebels then fled to the city of Gwalior, which contained another major fort. The Indian leader in charge of Fort Gwalior was originally loyal to the EIC. However, after negotiations led by Lakshmi Bai and Tatya Tope, the rebels were allowed to take control of the city. It was here that they also sought to bring back the power of the Maratha Confederacy by naming Nana Saheb, the other of Lakshmi Bai's childhood friends, as the new Peshwa. Unfortunately, this momentous occasion seemed to have made most of the rebels complacent. But not Lakshmi Bai. She knew that, once again, it was only a matter of time before the British came for her and her people. The others were not as quick to build up defenses around the city. On the 16th of June, the EIC army under Hugh Rose took the nearby town of Morar in preparation for their attack on Gwalior. The next day, the British descended on the city. Lakshmi Bai was given command over the eastern flank of the army. It's also said that she specifically wore a men's uniform for this fight. The Indians greatly outnumbered the British army, but that did not end up giving them any sort of advantage. At some point in the ensuing battle, Lakshmi Bai was attacked and knocked off her horse, possibly being stabbed through. The wound was fatal and Lakshmi Bai did not have long to live. There are two stories about how the Rani of Chansey died. The first is that Lakshmi Bai once again found the man who had injured her and fired at him with her gun. The man returned fire and shot her dead. The second story says that she managed to flee the battle. She also managed to find a hermit nearby and begged for him to watch over her body, because she did not want it to fall into British hands. The man was able to do this, and citizens from Gwalior retrieved Lakshmi Bai's corpse to cremate it. After 3 days, the company army defeated the rebels and captured Gwalior. It is such a shame to me that Lakshmi Bai's life ended in tragedy. She was a brilliant leader whose life was cut short just months before she turned 30 years old. Even the rebellion she fought in ended in failure. In November of 1858, the rebellion was officially put down. Emperor Bahadur Shah II was arrested for acts of treason. He was sent into exile where he died in 1862, thus bringing an end to the Mughal Empire. Nana Saheb died sometime in 1859, though inconsistent accounts mean no one really knows how that happened. This means that the Maratha Confederacy was also made obsolete. So, India fell into the hands of the East India Company. Except for the fact that it didn't. In August of 1858, Queen Victoria decided that the EIC had fumbled the entire operation and dissolved their power in India. From then on, the nation would be ruled directly by the British Crown, therefore making Victoria Empress of India. The UK ruled over the nation until 1947, when India was divided into itself and the nation of Pakistan, each given their own independence. Even in the aftermath of the rebellion, Lakshmi Bai was looked upon with admiration by both sides. To the Indian people, she was a hero of the rebellion, even if that rebellion had failed. To the British, she was one of the greatest and most powerful enemies they had to fight. Commander Hugh Rose, the man who captured Chansey and Gwalior, even would go on to give the bizarre quote, "The Indian mutiny has produced but one man, and that man was a woman, referring to Lakshmi Bai. Memorials to her can be found throughout all of India, especially in the city of Jhansi, usually depicting her on her horse with Damodar Rao tied to her back. Oh yeah, he would get to live, and Lakshmi Bai still has living descendants in India. During India's fight for independence in the 1940s, a woman's unit in the army was called the Rani of Jhansi Regiment. Many books, movies, and TV programs about her have also been made in India, where they are often said to play a particular role in motivating the young girls and women of the nation to aspire to greatness. So yeah, I will say again that I originally heard of Lakshmi Bai as the Joan of Arc of India. But again, that's a bad comparison. Jeanne d'Arc fought for her religion and to see France win the Hundred Years' War. She was a figurehead more than an actual military leader, but that's not to diminish her massive role in the fighting. Meanwhile, Lakshmi Bai was a woman conflicted in her desire to either live in peace or fight against one of the most powerful companies in the world. She was a woman who had to put everything aside, even if the odds were stacked against her. Honestly, there is another figure I could easily compare Lakshmi Bai to, and luckily I'll be covering her in a few episodes, so look out for that one. But for now, that's it for this week's episode of Royally Screwed. I hope you enjoyed the journey. Be sure to subscribe to the show and tell a friend all about it. Next time, we're doing another episode of Were They Great, the series within the series designed to figure out if rulers with the nickname The Great actually deserve that honor. So tune in as we look at a man who reshaped the Roman Empire and its futures in more ways than one as we look at the life of Constantine the Great. I hope you'll join me then for another topsy-turvy look into history's most interesting rulers.